Chapter 17. 29th of September, 1929. Dearest T, how are you? Well, I hope. I am now in Venice. We arrived last night, having taken the train from Paris after breakfast. We stopped over to visit Aunt M's favourite furrier. She needs some new coats to see her through the coldest months in Venice. Apparently the weather can be surprisingly harsh. Part of me wished we could have spent longer in Paris, but our tickets were already booked, and Aunt M was awaited in Venice. She is extremely popular here, you see. I love travelling by train, and Aunt M does it in some style. Our cabin was furnished with everything we could possibly need to sustain us. A hamper packed with things from Aunt M's favourite delicatessen in Paris, at least 20 novels, all of the newspapers, and a backgammon set for good measure. And yet I was too preoccupied with watching the land speed by us, watching as France, at some indiscernible point, became Italy. The passage across the lagoon is a dramatic one. All one can see, looking out of the window of the train, is grey-green water on either side. When we crossed, there was a low mist over the water, which added to the illusion that we were merely floating across the surface. It was getting dark when we pulled into the station. There was a boat waiting to take us to the palazzo, which is off the main canal. Lamps were being lit all along the banks, making for a rather eerie play of light and shadow over the buildings. I've never been anywhere quite like this city. It's a place preserved intact from another era, where the modern has hardly been allowed to intrude at all, so that everything looks exactly as it must have done several hundred years ago. When Aunt Em is away, the palazzo is kept in order by a man called Ludovico, who is something between a butler and a housekeeper, though I think either label would probably offend him. He is thin, elegant, and has an extraordinary mobile face. When he talks, expressions flit across it at an astonishing rate. He seemed delighted to see Aunt Em again, kissing her hand in a highly un-butler-like fashion, so it was more like the reunion of good friends than anything else. Then he rushed away, returning with a beautiful girl who bore a tray of drinks that had been made with fresh peach and an Italian sparkling wine that tastes like champagne. Ludovico called them Bellinis, the drink of Venice. I noticed that he joined us in drinking them too, as though we were all equals. Can you imagine such a thing happening in an English household? I rather approve. The palazzo itself is, Italian architecture aside, quite similar to Aunt Em's London home, meaning that it is full of art and various oddments and curiosities from her travels, African fertility statues, Chinese jade carvings, lanterns of Moroccan silver. But it has a unique feel to it too, which I think is something to do with the reflection of the water on the inside walls, so at times it feels as though one is not inside a house, but a large and beautiful boat. Aunt Em has a great many friends here. Some live in Venice permanently. Most are staying for a few months, like us. They are writers, musicians, and artists, some of whom I met at dinner here last night. I am sure they were unimpressed by me and my own lack of any special skill. I wish, then, that you were here. Perhaps by being associated with such a promising talent as yours, I might raise myself in the opinion of Aunt Em's friends. Anyway, dear T, do write back when you are able. I would so love to hear about how the painting is progressing, though I am sure it will be difficult to find much time to concentrate on it this year. Much love. A. Kiss. Venice is in many ways exactly as Alice has imagined it. Serene, eternal, slightly macabre. And yet she doesn't quite feel connected to it in the way she expected to. Perhaps it is that while the stones and water themselves represent the city of her imagining, the people don't. Where are the elegant citizens in their jewel-coloured velvets, their flowing cloaks and gowns? Vanished into history, apparently. In their place are flustered English and American tourists, with Baedeker guidebooks, huddled in gondolas, or buying up everything from one of the curiosity shops in the thoroughfares. Worse, she is only too aware of herself as one of these hapless visitors. She is convinced that there is another life, the life of the true Venetians, hidden behind a veil that is drawn to hide it from curious foreigners. She longs to discover it for herself. Strange things are afoot here, too, small ripples in the placid calm of things. Alice and Aunt Em are taking tea in the baroque splendour of Café Florian when a spectacle erupts in St. Mark's Square. A phalanx of men appear, as though from stage right, to wheel and march before them to the bellowed orders of their commanding officer. All are dressed in impeccable black serge, their boots buff to an impossible shine. The scene is at once both comical in its absurdity and terrible. There is certainly more than a little of the ridiculous about such display of modernity and precision amid these gorgeous but visibly decaying surroundings. At the same time, there is something deadly in the intent, in the intrinsic menace of it, that disturbs Alice. "Very sad," Aunt Margaret pronounces, taking a sip of her coffee, which she ordered laced with brandy to keep out the autumn chill. "I fear this country will soon be a changed place. You are visiting it at the right time. You have come, I think, as a tide is turning. Who knows what will emerge in its wake?" A meagre crowd had gathered to watch. Alice scrutinises the faces. Most are preoccupied with finding shelter from the sudden shower that has blown in across the lagoon. Many appear apathetic. There are, however, a number who are clearly stirred, even excited by the display. Alice takes a draught of her hot chocolate. It is as thick as custard, a tiny velvet quantity. The taste, older than the cafe itself, but well known within its gilt-lined walls, of rarefied privilege. A taste from Venice, the city-state, Venice, the august, the illustrious. As she savours the taste, she is suddenly aware of the strangest impression, that she and Aunt Margaret are sitting in a different century, looking upon the future from front row seats. 7th of October, 1929. Dearest T, thank you for your letter. I can't wait to see the new pieces. You sound so excited by them, and I have no doubt they will be even more brilliant than the others I have seen. I'm impressed that you are able to paint or draw at all. I seem to recall that the awful stepbrother had a terrible time of it in his last year. Some rather dramatic weather here of late, great storms sweeping in across the lagoon, and St. Mark's Square was under a foot of water for a few days. You had to take a boat to get across it, and there were people wearing boots like fishing waders that came up to mid-thigh. I love it, though. Whilst I haven't seen the city in the summer months, I can't imagine I would love it nearly as much as this city of wet and wind. It also means that most of the tourists here have disappeared. They prefer this place when it is crowded, sunlit and perhaps somewhat saccharine, in the way that so many European cities become in the summer. Lunches in the sun and ice cream and gleaming gilt finishes everywhere the eye can see. Venice in October is quiet and dark, even during the shortening hours of day, for the water, opaquely green, seems to absorb light and sound. At night, it is black as pitch in the less busy parts, and one can glance off the thoroughfares down any number of inky waterways to where moored boats jostle against their bow lines in the gloom. You can imagine murders and love affairs going on in the shadows. This city is full of hiding places for those who don't want to be seen. I'm getting carried away, I know, but Venice has that effect upon me. One thing I do find unsettling is the presence of soldiers throughout the city. The black uniforms make their appearance always sudden and so incongruous against the background of elegant old streets and squares, all the more sinister. Aunt M does not care for it at all and keeps speaking of what she calls a great change in Europe. Apparently these men are the fascisti. Whatever the reason for it, their presence troubles me too. I know I have said it already, but I do wish you were here. Aunt M is marvellous fun, but she is more than double my age, as are most of her friends, and her arthritic hip, which I'm sure is worse in this damp climate, though she refuses to admit it, means that she is disinclined to walk far or spend much time out of doors. I can't help thinking what fun it would be to explore the city together, you and me, the way we did Wynard Cove, discovering its secrets, its hidden wonders. I know there is more to be discovered here, no doubt a grimier, less picturesque and far more exciting place that I have seen nothing of. Do write soon. I am longing to hear your news. Much love. A. Kiss. From the balcony of her bedroom, Alice can see the busy thoroughfare of the Grand Canal and beyond, out to the distant blue haze of the lagoon itself and the outlines of faraway boats. When she watches these shapes moving incrementally closer or farther away, embarking upon unknowable voyages to other lands, she feels something move and shift inside her, a feeling somewhere between excitement and despair. While she is here, staying in with her aunt, she can imagine that she is a person with a purpose to call her own, with options beyond those that usually appear available to her, with independence. In reality, she is none of these things. Coming to Venice, the thrill of this small voyage out of her usual sphere of existence has shown her how much more she wants to do with her life than would be possible in that confining sphere her mother expects her to enter. She wants to live courageously. Later, Alice and Lady Margaret attend a party thrown by one of Margaret's illustrious friends. Alice is again out of her depth in this smoke and talk-filled room, surrounded by the great and important. She feels talentless and uninteresting. That woman over there is apparently a famous novelist, and this man here, with the round glasses, is a preeminent psychoanalyst, whose recent paper has challenged much of the common thinking surrounding the Freudian concept of the hysteric. What does Alice do, they ask? Nothing? Really? How on earth does she spend her time in that case? Alice seeks refuge in the ruby-coloured drinks that are being passed round. A Negroni, the waiter tells her, and after the first sip, she decides she hates it. It is bitter, almost medicinal, and eye-wateringly strong. Yet she perseveres, for it is the only thing available, and everyone else seems to be drinking them without complaint. She is determined not to be shown up further by her immature palate. By the bottom of the third glass, Negronis are Alice's favourite drink in the world. She could bathe in them. She is also rather drunk, though still in that strange interim stage whereby she is not so inebriated that she is unaware of the fact and conscious of the need to do something about it. She slips from the room, letting herself out through the glass doors at the side of the room that lead onto the balcony, intent on getting a breath of air inside her lungs, clearing her head of the alcohol and the fog of cigarette smoke. It is perfect, cool and quiet, save for the secret sound of the gentle moving water. On the opposite bank, several lanterns hang reflected in the water as glowing orbs of light. In Alice's stupefied state, the subtle movements of these reflections are mesmerizing. She sits down on a stone bench amid the shrubbery and plant pots, then half lies down and presses her hot face against the cold seat. The sensation is deliciously soothing. At some point she must have fallen asleep, because a sudden disturbance has her returning groggily to herself. Alice is at a loss as to what it is that has woken her, until she hears a voice.
"Rather cool for sleeping under the stars," he says.
He walks towards her, picking his way through the greenery. She sits up, and his face swims into focus. Not a conventionally handsome man, perhaps, though he is rather romantic-looking, if such a distinction can be made. His nose is too large for his face, with an odd flatness across the bridge, suggesting that it had once been broken. His lips are too thin, though there is something attractive, purposeful about the set of them. He regards Alice inquisitively, as if an answer is expected of her, and she realizes that she must have been staring. "Sorry," she says. "I came out here to clear my head." Her words stick to her tongue, run together thickly. She feels how she must look to him, a dishevelled, drunken child. Yet he smiles and nods.
"Me too. Too much hot air in there. Most of it provided by the occupants."
Alice laughs, pleasantly scandalized, feeling the fog of alcohol begin to lift. He takes a couple of steps closer.
"I confess I followed you out here. It looked as though you had found the perfect escape route. I don't want to intrude, though."
His accent is good, but not perfect. There is a telltale guttural sound of the R, the dropping of the H. A Frenchman, she thinks. She shakes her head. "Not at all. It's nice to have company."
"Was it very bad in there?"
Pretty awful. A bit tired of all those writers. Alice gestures with her hands vaguely. There is much more that she wants to say on the subject, but she cannot articulate it.
She shuffles along the bench to give him space, and he sits, letting out a grateful sigh, as though he has travelled far through the night to rest here beside her. Aware anew of the chill of the October air, Alice wonders whether it is because it has been thrown into relief by the warmth of his form beside her. She notices, too, now that he is so close, that he has beautiful hair, as dark as her own, growing in tight curls. She feels a sudden, almost irresistible urge to place her palm against it, to test the spring of it. She is still trying to make up her mind whether or not to do so, her hand hovering dangerously at her side, when he speaks again. "So, you must be Alice?" She stares at him as though he has performed a magic trick. "How did you guess?"
"Lady Marguerite surely does not have more than one beautiful young niece here in Venice."
It could sound caddish, this line, but he pulls it off, something perhaps to do with the way he delivers it, the ironic quirk of his mouth.
"I heard that you were visiting from England."
"Well," she says with bravado, "since you're so well informed about me, may I ask who you are?"
"I'm Julian."
"How do you know my aunt?"
"One of my friends is an artist who has sold her a couple of pieces," Julian explains, "and some of your aunt's acquaintances have sympathies with my own work, including our host, the novelist."
He quirks an eyebrow.
"I confess that I am a writer too of sorts. Don't crucify me," he says, holding up his hands as Alice rolls her eyes at him. "I promise I am not going to bore you with a long lecture on the modern style. I don't write novels. My work as a writer is secondary to my work as a man of action. I write about what I believe in, that which I would prefer to act upon than write about should the opportunity present itself."
At her blank look, he explains he is a member of Le Parti Communiste Français.
"Several of us have come over to meet with our Italian brothers, to find out how they are faring with all that has been happening here. Life has become rather complicated for them of late."
He smiles down at her.
"So tell me, who is Alice? What does she do?"
"Nothing," she says with a shrug. "At least nothing worth mentioning. I'm not talented, you see. I was good at lessons when I was at school, but..."
"Alice," he says, cutting her off. "How old are you?"
22.
"Exactly. So tell me, please, how on earth are you supposed to know what your talents are at 22? When I was your age, I wasn't half as interesting a person as you are now."
She looks up at him and wonders how old he is. She sees, too, in the light thrown from one of the lanterns, that his eyes aren't black as she'd first thought, but a dark, almost navy blue, fringed with thick lashes. These eyes give him a roguish, slightly piratical look.
"You mustn't let that crowd in there crush you," he says. "They may be talented, a few of them at least. They may be celebrated, but they aren't necessarily interesting in their own right. Most of them are phonies through and through. Your Aunt Margaret, she's a good sort, though, knows the wheat from the chaff."
His knowledge of this expression emphasizes his fluency. "Where did you learn to speak English so well?" she asks.
"I do. I'm flattered. I studied at Cambridge for 3 years, a long time ago now, but it stuck with me. It's a beautiful language, not as celebrated as it should be. People talk about the elegance of French, but it's a dusty tongue, antique, unevolved."
He asks her what she has seen of Venice. She lists the sights and he shakes his head, apparently appalled.
"So, you haven't ventured out of San Marco?"
"The square?"
"The Sestere. The district of the city that we're in now."
"No, I don't think so."
"In that case, you've seen barely a sixth of this city."
"Oh," she says, stung. "Well, Aunt Margaret can't go far at the moment because her hip has got worse. I'm sure if she could, she'd take me."
"I think you need a guide," Julian says thoughtfully. "Would your aunt consider me a suitable chaperone? I've been here several times before, you see. I know my way about rather well."
"I don't think she'd have an objection. In fact, I'm fairly sure she would have let me go off on my own if I'd asked her. She'd probably think it an excellent idea."
"Well then, how about the day after next? Tomorrow I have plans, but Thursday can be yours alone."
Alice finds herself agreeing. Beneath the mist of alcohol that has dulled her senses,
She feels a bolt of anticipation shoot through her.
Have you a Baedeker?
She nods. Yes, of course.
Throw it away. You don't need it for my tour. I like the parts of a city that are more mixed. You can't find my version of Venice in your tourist manual.
When Alice asks her aunt over supper, Lady Margaret is as sanguine about the plan as Alice had anticipated. How wonderful that you should have the chance to explore the city with someone closer to your age. How old is he exactly? Alice shrugs.
I didn't ask. He talks as though he's ancient.
Excellent, says Lady Margaret.
A man of the world is by far the most interesting sort. Well, you will get much more from the experience, I should think, than you get from travelling about with me. Alice tries to demur, but Lady Margaret holds up a hand. You are kind to protest, but I am certain that is the case. She takes a thoughtful sip of her wine, which, incidentally, is an almost perfect match for the pigment she has applied to her hooded eyelids. It is her third, or perhaps fourth, glass to Alice's one, and Alice would be unable to think by this stage had she consumed the same. Yet the alcohol appears to have no effect whatsoever on her relative. Aunt Em is as lucid and eloquent, if anything slightly more so, than ever.
Julian Arnoux, she says thoughtfully. I have read some of his work, and he writes well, though I must admit I do not agree with all of his theories, or the sentiment with which they are expressed. That is not to say they don't intrigue me, but there is too much violence in them, when the world is violent enough already.
Then, in a mercurial way that is her wont, she changes topic.
Have you heard from that friend of yours? The artist? The one who adores you?
Alice feels her face grow hot. How is it that her aunt is always able to get right to the heart of things?
He doesn't adore me, Aunt Em.
Lady Margaret gives her a look. Alice braces herself for more, but her aunt takes pity on her.
I was impressed with his work. I know that I was probably on the harsh side when I critiqued it.
Well, in a few years' time, I would be extremely interested to see how he has progressed, she shrugged. But then it may all come to nothing, especially if he gives in and goes on to, what was it?
Law.
Yes, I remember now. That's what his parents want.
Then we must hope that he has the strength to resist, for all our sakes. Why was it, Alice thinks, as she makes her way back to her room, that when Aunt Em was talking of Tom, she was aware of an odd, unpleasant sensation within her, almost as though something had lodged in her chest? It is there, still, in fact. A feeling curiously like guilt. She reminds herself that she has not done anything to harm him, nothing of which she should be ashamed. Not yet, says an inner voice. You haven't yet.
29th of October, 1929. Dearest T, I hope you are well, though I am sure I need not ask as it sounds as if things are better than ever. Your letter arrived yesterday with your news about the exhibition. I know you say it's only a few pieces, but I think it's so exciting. I have no doubt they will far outshine any of the others. Not particularly sportsmanlike of me, perhaps. I only wish I could be there to sing your praises to visitors, and to boast about having discovered you. Please don't sell everything. You must have something saved for me to buy when I come home, and especially not that drawing you made by the lake. I think you know the one. I, too, have exciting news. I have found a partner in crime. He is no Tom Stafford, but still, he is someone to explore the city with. I met him at a party given by a friend of Aunt Em. It was rather a dull affair for me, anyway, as I am getting somewhat tired of being made to feel gauche, untalented and uninteresting. You, as an artist, would have been celebrated no end. I, though, am barely more than a poorly educated schoolgirl to them. And then I met Julian, or perhaps a better way of phrasing it is to say he rescued me. I do not know much about him, other than that he is French but knows Venice well, and he speaks excellent English, because he spent several years in England. At a guess, I would say he is around 30. What's more, he's a ret. Imagine what the wicked stepfather would do if he knew. Anyway, Julian has offered to show me around the city tomorrow. He calls it the alternative tour, because he claims that it would never appear in the pages of a tourist manual, which is, naturally, a good thing. I shall tell you how it goes. One day, perhaps, we shall come back to Venice together, you and I will be able to give you the tour myself. All my love. A. Kiss.